and standing around the fringe of the meeting, just listening and not members of the meeting, were a lot of white students from the University of South Carolina. And when he got to this big peroration, the next thing you know, some big black bog negro will be rapping on the door asking for your daughter's hand in marriage. They spontaneously said, well, she could say no, couldn't she? And it's just that silly. But each step of the way this goes along, and each step of the way they have lost, and each step of the way they have found new ways of fighting back, and at the same time the Negroes and their allies have tried to use the courts. Then we get up through these decision after decision after decision, we get this decision on the elementary and high school level. And there they were in trouble. The first place, it was a unanimous decision. It was by 9 justices, including 3 from the Deep South. And so all they could do was rant and rave. And then they started careful planning, which anybody with any sense knew they would have to do. It was working too well. County after county and state after state, between May of 54 and September of the past year, had moved to completely desegregate their schools. As a matter of fact, I would be unfair if I stood in the state of Illinois and didn't say that southern states like Missouri and West Virginia made more progress than has been made in southern Illinois in getting rid of segregated schools. But they made terrific progress. And if nothing had blocked it, the good people in these southern states would have worked together to do it in a lawful manner, regardless of how many years they might have needed to do it. And it would have been worked out. But they couldn't allow that because they knew that the day that Negro and white kids went to elementary school together and to high school together and went into the armed services on an integrated basis and came out into the colleges and went to school on an integrated basis, the politicians of the South knew as soon as that happened, they would have to get something better than the race issue to get reelected on. And having not mentality for anything else, they would be out of business. That they knew. So something had to be done. And if you want to know why these people have been murdered, why we have these other pressures I'll tell you about, it develops at the beginning of what was known as the White Citizens' Councils in the South. They started in Mississippi, and they spread like wildfire. They're not the Ku Klux Klan type. Oh, no. They're the best people in the community. Invariably, you'll find that the chairman of the committee in town, A or B, will be either the president of the bank or the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce or the local judge. They say they're opposed to violence, but they're opposed to desegregation, and they will do everything lawful to maintain segregation. Then we get in a lot of trouble with what they consider to be lawful. They admit that they use every economic pressure possible. In one town in Mississippi, Yazoo City. Some 30-odd Negroes signed a petition with the school board asking the school board to desegregate the schools. The White Citizens Council published that list on the back page of the daily paper and warned all of the readers to take whatever steps they needed to take to get those names off. in the group were two Negro grocerymen. They couldn't buy a loaf of bread wholesale. They couldn't buy anything. They were driven out of business. That is, quote, lawful, end quote. A plumbing contractor has run out of business. All three of them up in Chicago trying to make a living. Everyone on that list who had a job was immediately fired. They say that's lawful. Every Negro with a mortgage on his land who signed the school petition was pushed, and foreclosures were started. The only thing we could do was to pool our resources and get all the organizations we could find willing to do something instead of talking about it, to put money in a Memphis bank, the Tri-State Bank, so that that money could be in turn loaned to the Negroes in Mississippi to save their property. We started out to get $125,000 in that fund. I want you to know that fund now runs $325,000. And it broke the back of that one, because as soon as the mortgage boys that were getting 10 and 12%, you know, they had no limits down there with the Negro involved, they were holding up this money away from them, denying themselves the 10 and 12% interest in order to keep the Negroes from standing up for their rights. Lo and behold, the Negroes are still standing up for their rights and getting their money someplace else. So all they end up with is losing 10 and 12%. So we found many of them notifying the Negroes that if you come around the back door so nobody sees you, I'll lend you the money. That didn't stop them. Now they refuse to let Negroes have crop loans to put the crop in the ground so they can, it's the only thing they can live on. Every step of the way, they're going to block them. Negro service station that can't get gasoline to sell. Negro soda vendors that can't get certain kinds of soda to sell. And as a result of this atmosphere of saying that the Supreme Court is a deliberate communist infiltrated body, etc., and all of these other things that I hate to repeat, they created the atmosphere in Mississippi that makes it possible for the hoodlums to murder Negroes and go scot-free. And you cannot say you're not responsible for that. They moved over to South Carolina and did the same thing. In the town of Orangeburg, South Carolina, in the little town of Ellery nearby, at one time, a Negro couldn't buy a bottle of milk for his child. That's lawful yet. They wouldn't sell him anything. Then they said they would agree to sell. Those Negroes set up a counter boycott down there, bless their souls. They set up carpools and went into Columbia and bought their stuff in Columbia, South Carolina. Gas stations down there run out of business. That's the type of thing we don't realize is going on. That's the type of thing I tell you that we're up against right now in Alabama. This is what I want to get to. Because you've heard about the Arthurine Lucy case. And I know you've marveled at the fact, marvel is not the word, you're shocked at the fact that one lone Negro girl could wreck a whole state university. And what I love is how somebody can say in one breath that anything that white is supreme and white supremacy must be maintained, and then say that one poor colored girl can contaminate 7,000 white students. You were shocked at what happened, yes. I was shocked because it's the first campus that any Negro student has attended in the Deep South where anything like this has happened. On every other campus, the Negroes were welcomed by the students. On every other campus, the Negroes were welcomed by the faculty. And on this campus, they're opposed by both. What happened? I'll tell you what happened. The White Citizens' Council came over from Mississippi into Alabama. And they organized the community and the campus. They made it impossible for any Negro student to go there. And so we were all shocked at what happened. And now there are a lot of us that are not too shocked. The reason we're not too shocked, because again, we're doing the same thing that everybody else has been doing all along. We've been trying to wash the guilt off of our own minds. We've been trying to excuse away and justify. And indeed, it just so happens that I read all good newspapers. And I read your campus newspaper. Just like the New York Times. All the news that's fit to print. Before I get to this last part of what I have to say, I want to read parts of this. You know that letter that came from the student at Alabama University? I think this is unbelievable that anybody would pay enough attention to it to print such a letter. I find from this letter what I find in a lot of thinking, that Miss Arthurine Lucy is solely responsible for everything that happened down there. She threw the rocks. She threw the tomatoes. She threw the rotten eggs. She defied the president. She was the 2,000 mob that was bent on killing her. She had those 8 rifles that were found fully loaded, including 6 high-powered rifles. She was the one that had the rope that she was going to be lynched by. How can you blame one colored girl for what everybody else did? It said in this letter that what brought it about was the fact that she drove up in a large, latest model Cadillac. So what? Is it a crime to have a Cadillac? Is it crime to ride in a Cadillac? Must all Negroes not have a Cadillac because I can't afford one? There are more Jaguars, Thunderbirds, and MGs on the campus of the University of Alabama than any of you in this audience have ever seen. And on Fraternity Row, I doubt they have anything there smaller than a convertible Cadillac. I've been on Fraternity Row down there. But it's wrong for a Negro to have a Cadillac. It wasn't her car. Friend drove her down there. So that's what started it. She drove up in a Cadillac. Now, according to this letter, the next thing that happened, she was accompanied with a corps of television and newspaper cameramen and reporters. That's just a lie. She was not accompanied by anybody but one reporter. And he wasn't a real reporter. He's the owner of a newspaper. She was escorted through the registration without having to stand in line. She was escorted by the Dean of Women of the University of Alabama. The Dean of Women came out and says, I imagine you are Arthurine Lucy. She said, yes. She said, well, come with me. Well, what's she supposed to do? Say, I'm not going to go with you. I'm going to stand here. What's she supposed to do? All of these great details. While they rushed ahead of everyone else, the other students had to stand in line and wait. This caused resentment. Now they say her back has pushed her just to see how far they could go. There were no backers there. Then they said when she was refused dormitory space, she went charged out there charging with threats of, quote, determined to get in the dormitory if I have to get a court order, end of quote. That is a deliberate lie. She never said it. And she's denied this under oath, incidentally. And it was that way about everything. In place of being humble and modest, her backers pushed her into saying she was going to court, etc. Then it says it all adds up to a flair for publicity. And that she was overdressed. That's what it says here.